So I'm now going to talk about the financing of long-term care in the United Kingdom. The title for this whole session referred to private long-term care insurance. In one sense, I could be extremely brief on this. It is simply not available today. But, of course, we do have things to say, though. So, I mean, first of all, can I acknowledge that the work I'm going to talk about is funded by the Department of Health here, by the AXA Research Fund, and that I've been working with a group of colleagues both here at LSE, at the University of East Anglia, and elsewhere. And we've been conducting over, actually coming on for 20 years, I guess, a whole series of projects at the PSSCU at LSE and also at Kent as well, on the financing of long-term care, which have included comparative international studies. And we've had the opportunity, which we're grateful for, to provide information and advice and analysis to inform a whole lot of reviews over that period, since roughly the start of the Blair government. The key issue here has been the balance, really, between public responsibility and private responsibility in an era, first of all, of course, of demographic pressures, as is very well known, and then more recently, of course, the last several years now, of course, of considerable public expenditure constraints. Just very briefly, I think it'd be very familiar to you, the situation in the UK is that healthcare is basically free at point of use, funded out principally out of general taxation. That is not true of personal care, which is means-tested, except in Scotland, where for older people it is sort of more or less free. And the means test is quite a tight means test, not unlike that of Medicaid, really, taking account of both wealth and income. But in particular, two features to note: people with wealth more than just about £23,000, what, €25,000, are not eligible for local authority support. And the value of the house is taken into account if someone enters residential care in most cases, unless they have a spouse or close relative still living in it. Very briefly, some facts and figures on the situation here. Actually, these data relate to England rather than the whole of the UK. About 3.5% of our older population are living in care homes, of whom over 40% are required to pay for their care in full privately, with the rest funded either by the NHS in some specialised circumstances or by subsidy from their local authority. For community-based care, we don't have such detailed figures, unfortunately, but 500,000 older people are receiving some sort of publicly funded social care in the community, not necessarily intensive home care. And an uncertain number are paying for home care privately. And those who do get local authority-funded care have to meet a fair proportion of the costs. On average, over a third, if they're in local authority-funded residential care, or about an eighth, typically, on average, if they're receiving local authority-funded home-based care. So now to private insurance. Analysis conducted by my colleagues Jules Ford, who's here, and Jose Luis Fernandez found that about 10% of people turning 65 can expect to face long-term care costs of over £100,000 over the rest of their lives. I should say this is not private funding, it's £100,000 in total, whoever's paying for it. On classic economic arguments, if people are risk-averse, and you'd expect them to be facing this type of potential loss, it would surely be more efficient for them to be able to obtain insurance, whether private purchase or through social insurance. Yet, as I've said, long-term care insurance, the traditional types of on the US model, let's say, is simply not purchasable in the United Kingdom. The one sort of related product that is available is so-called immediate needs product. That's to say, if someone enters a care home, they can buy what amounts to a type of impaired life annuity at very advantageous rates. Nevertheless, I believe the cost is getting on towards £100,000 for that. Otherwise, you cannot buy genuine insurance that takes account of the risk of needing care as opposed to just the risk of longevity on needing care. There have been various market failures, and one of the issues is exactly what these market failures have been. These are some of the suggestions, and I think that Emmanuel also referred to this earlier. It appears that people, first of all, probably underestimate their need of requiring long-term care in late old age and or the duration and cost of that care, and overestimate what the state will do. There's a mistaken, or has been, a mistaken impression that the NHS will fund it or that social care is funded on a similar basis to the NHS. What I'm not sure is whether this has changed recently. There's been just so much publicity on this issue. On talking to actuaries working in this area in the industry, they've referred in discussions we've had to the lack of adequate data. And I think, again, Emmanuel, I think, made this point for France. There isn't really the robust data to calculate the premiums accurately. And I guess this is sort of a vicious circle. If you don't have the products, you don't get the data, and therefore you don't have the data to cost the products, so it becomes more difficult to launch the products. Products were available in the 1990s here. They started around about 1990. A number of the big players entered the market. By around 2000, they had left it again. One of the differences I've just referred to is pricing the product accurately, and I gather that the companies who offer these policies began to suspect that they'd underpriced them. And as it was, demand was poor. And I found on talking to actuaries, referred a lot to the difficulty in selling it and persuading people that that it was value for money for them, in effect. So you had this vicious circle of low uptake. I don't think there were ever more than about 35,000 enrollees in the UK. And feeling that you probably had to push up your premiums because they were probably insufficient. So the answer was to leave the market, and that's what happened. And these sort of market failures relating combination of demand and supply side failures, I think were one of the reasons, perhaps the main reason, why the Dilnot Commission, to which I'll be coming back to, recommended what amounts to a type of public sector insurance with a high excess. So I'm now going to refer to one of the studies that we've done in recent years. This was funded by the AXA Research Fund and commissioned from PSSAU together with other research institutions. It had a number of aims, two of which I'm mentioned on this slide. One was to present estimates of the expected lifetime costs of care for older people in the UK under various scenarios. And the other was to produce an estimate of what the premiums might have to be if such products were to be relaunched today, and to be reasonably generous. I mean, a rather different sort of product from the French one. Sorry, gone the wrong way. We produced our estimates. Actually, we produced several versions of estimates to say that our colleague partner institutions in Spain, also the Nuffield Trust here, also produced estimates in different ways. I'm going to concentrate, actually, on those produced at the PSSIU using what we call our sort of aggregate modelling methodologies. As it happens, the estimates from the different methods which we triangulated were not vastly different. And pleasingly, they were fairly close. Actually, the ones I'm presenting are, I think, that just at the top end of the range. We used a model that we've been developing really over the years, which contained information on the receipt of services by age, gender, household composition, etc., and also on disability, particularly in terms of activities of daily living, similarly by age and gender and socioeconomic variables. With this, we were able to look at the proportion of people with different levels of disability, different ages, and the proportions receiving different services by age, and the associated costs. And using Sullivan's method, we estimated what is the, of the period of life from age 65 onwards, how much of that time could the average older person expect to be in a care home, how much of that time could they expect to be receiving intensive home care and lower intensive home care. And similarly, how much of that time could they expect to be experiencing severe limitations with different numbers of activities of daily living. We can then sum them up over the rest of the lifetime and put costs to it, or we sum the costs, actually. To do this, we have, of course, to make a series of base case assumptions. We use the official Office of National Statistics life expectancy and mortality projections. We assume that disability rates of, in terms of ADLs will remain constant by age and gender. And to that, I'll come back. We assume the patterns of care will remain as of today for those costings that relate to patterns of care. We assume also that the real terms, unit costs of care, that's if, say, an hour's home care, will either remain constant or will rise by about 2% a year in real terms, broadly in line there with average earnings. We look only at care costs, not hotel costs of residential care, and therefore excluding about £10,000 of the residential care fee. We also assume that real interest rates will remain zero. If that sounds odd, I remember, that, of course, they've been negative for some years now. So these are just an indication, really, of our findings. This shows the lifetime cost, estimated expected lifetime cost, from age 65 at 2010-11 prices. And our finding, therefore, is about £37,000, let's say in the range £35,000 to £40,000, on the zero real rise in cost assumptions, or getting on for £60,000 if they rise at 2% a year. And there's, of course, quite a big gender difference, as you'd imagine, given differences not only in life expectancy but in disability rates, and also on expectations around, or likelihoods really, around unpaid care, because this, I should say, of course, relates to formal care. Not there's no unpaid care evaluations here. We looked at how this might vary under different official ONS projections on mortality rates, and within this particular period and range, not a vast difference. What does make a bigger difference is if disability rates changed in a less favourable manner. And for this, we drew on work by Professor Carol Jagger at the University of Newcastle. She's done a whole range of simulation work on future patterns of disease and risk factors and their implications for disability. And the projections we've looked here in the second row are assuming that prevalence of chronic conditions remain constant, not ADL, disability rates. And that actually leads to considerably higher expected lifetime costs of care. I mentioned earlier that as well as looking at the lifetime costs of care under the sort of broadly current patterns of formal care in England, we also looked at what would the likely cost be if people spent a fixed amount for a given disability threshold. And the threshold we looked at here was failure of two activities of daily living. Let's say inability to perform this activity without help, or residence in a care home. And we found that if the person was spending £350 a week for that level of disability, that would just about equate to the current pattern of care costs. So we get £37,000 in either case, albeit it's just slightly different gender balance. So that was on the lifetime costs of care, and I'm now turning to insurance premiums. Supposing insurance did become available again of the type that existed in the 1990s, and broadly the type I think that exists in the United States. Clearly the premiums need to cover not only the expected payouts, the so-called loss, but also the expected admin costs and the need to have a return to the shareholders and the companies and so on. And Josh Wiener kindly advised us on rates in the United States, where I gather the loss ratio is about 60% on individual and 70% on group policies. Taking that into account, and also taking account that our partners in this study had slightly lower lifetime costs calculations, we thought that a lump sum premium at age 65 would need to be in this £35,000 to £60,000 range as a lump sum at age 65, or this rather higher £50,000 to £80,000 range if it was to allow for expected real inflation in care costs. Now, people in the States, I gather, don't normally pay with a lump sum, but rather a weekly premium. And that weekly, or monthly premium, would need to be in that range of £210 to £335 pounds per month at 2010 prices in order to sort of match the lump sum cost. So very considerable premiums, as indeed they were when these policies were available in the 1990s, not affordable by the majority of people living on combinations of state and personal pensions. Sorry. So I'm now turning to the proposals of the Commission on the Funding of Care and Support. As you know, they recommended that there should be a lifetime cap on care costs of between £25,000 and £50,000. As Benry Kaysen mentioned yesterday, that doesn't mean all care costs. People would still be responsible for their hotel costs in a care home. This is just care costs. And also there would, of course, be a limit on the amounts local authorities could or would be expected to pay for residential care. So this would be at local authority general fee rates. And we believe, we don't have very good data on this, about coming on for a third of people receiving local authority-funded residential care now have to pay a supplement, or in fact their relatives do, because the care home is charging fees above the agreed rate. So one needs to realize this is not everything covered. What the government decided to do, as you know, from spring 2016, there will be a cap a bit higher than the Dilnot Commission recommended, even you know after the inflation adjustment, of £72,000. So that will provide a wide pooling of the lifetime risk, if you like, but with this very large excess to the user of £72,000 potentially. Of course, I should have said the user's poor. Of course, they will also be the means-tested system to rely on. So it's for people who are more wealthy, but not necessarily very wealthy, they would need to meet a large chunk of cost, and the majority of the users would not, in fact, live long enough to reach the cap. But the question then is, and something that the government I know has been interested in and been discussing with the financial services sector, is does this provide new scope for a different type of product, maybe a little bit more like the French one in some ways, because it could be much less generous payouts that could cover either the hotel costs or this excess of 72,000 possibly, or maybe most likely would enable people to buy slightly more costly care than the state would cover even under the cap. So I'm now going to turn to another study which we did, and this was commissioned by the Department of Health on behalf of the independent expert commission that recommended the cap, the so-called Dilnot Commission. We actually did two studies, one in respect of older people and one in respect of the younger adult group. But I'm going to talk about the work we did in respect of older people. And we conducted this particular study in collaboration with Ruth Hancock and her colleagues at the University of East Anglia using their microsimulation model known as CareSim in collaboration, conjunction, I should say, I suppose, with our macrosimulation model. And this work was designed to triangulate other pieces of dynamic microsimulation work done by Jules Forde and José Luis Fernández. So it was a triangulation piece of work along with this other study. I don't really have time here to go into the very detailed methodology. Very briefly, we make the same sort of base case assumptions as I mentioned in our other study. That's to say, prevalence rates of disability remaining constant, unit costs rising by 2% a year in real terms, and the pattern of care remaining unchanged. And this projection takes account of likely changes in unpaid care by spouses, but does make a rather optimistic assumption about future unpaid care by adult children. So these are perhaps on the low end of what's likely. So as of 2010, about £12 billion was spent on long-term care for older people, public expenditure, including both long-term health care and long-term social care, and an element also of disability benefits used to fund care. And we projected that under the current arrangements, without the cap, without the government's reforms, this would need to more than double in constant prices by 2030, rising from under 1% of GDP to about 1.3% of GDP. And this is just the public expenditure. The government's reforms, we have estimated, would add about $2 billion to this in 2010 prices by 2030, taking us up to about 1.4% of GDP. So not a vast amount relative to GDP, but by no means a trivial amount either. So just to very briefly conclude, private long-term care insurance is currently not available in the UK. This seems to be due to the interaction between a series of demand and supply side market failures. This may change with the, you know, maybe I believe the industry is looking at this again following the decision to implement the cap. Our estimates are that the premiums could be very considerable, over £200 a month potentially, if the policy is purchased at age 65 and if it provides reasonably generous payouts for those who fail ADLs. The government has, meanwhile, of course, decided to implement the cap from April 2016 at a relatively high level, meaning that we will have a sort of social insurance with this huge excess. As I've said, we reckon that this policy will add about $2 billion to public expenditure, 2010 prices, by 2030. Thank you very much.